45 degrees Kenosha, 46 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part one of today's program is going to be a conversation about what sounds like an incredibly intriguing play that is about to be performed at Carthage in its studio theater. It's a play by Lee Blessing called Eleemosynary. And it is a cast of three, and we have the entire cast with us in our studio, as well as the gifted Carthage student who is the director of this production, Emily Hoffman, who's been on the morning show before. She is a music theater and directing double major with a Spanish minor. She is a senior, so this is her senior thesis project. And as I said, with us are the three also gifted Carthage students who comprise her cast. And this is a play that involves three women who are three generations of the same family. And a complicated family it is, to say the least. Playing the oldest of the three characters is the youngest student in the room, Lily Anderson, who is a computer science major with a theater minor. You're a senior.
Yes.
So you're not the youngest student. No,
I'm not.
Okay, but you're playing the oldest character. There we go. Playing the middle character in terms of generations is Jessie Sconesi. She is the youngest of these students in the room. She is a theater performance major with a French minor. And then playing the youngest of the three family members is yet another senior, Ellie Nybert, who is a music theater and choreography double major. And again, directing them all is Emily Hoffman in her senior thesis project. And this play by Lee Blessing, Eleemosynary, is going to be performed this coming Saturday, Sunday, and Monday in Carthage's Studio Theater. We welcome all four of you to the morning show.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good to have you here. Thanks for getting up bright and early. So, Emily, let's talk first a moment about this whole matter of the senior thesis, which
yes.
looms over every senior as they approach what they hope will be graduation. It's something that everybody has to do, a gauntlet that has to be run. So tell us, first of all, what sort of the options were for you. I mean, when somebody is majoring in what you're majoring in, what does the senior thesis typically look like, and how did this take shape for you?
Well, for a directing major, there's not a whole lot of options. You should direct. So about a year ago, I submitted a proposal. Yeah, October of last year, I submitted a proposal for two shows, and then the faculty selected one, and I was approved for a studio show. So that's kind of the first step and set us on our journey from there.
There you go. So tell us about what drew you to this particular play, Lee Blessing's Eleemosynary.
Oh, boy. I had worked on a scene as part of another class, which kind of introduced me to Lee Blessing. And I had read some of his other work, and he has such a unique style. But I specifically was looking for plays about with strong female characters. I love plays about science and history and informative plays. And so this was kind of a play that brought all of those things together. But when I read it further, I was like, oh, maybe this isn't actually, you know, a traditional feminist play. I think it's just a play about people. Mm. So I was like, oh, you know, we're casting and catering to the group of students that we have, but also it's a play that can still reach anybody across generations.
Right. So you've never seen this play before, I assume.
Nope.
What's it like to read a script in terms of not only just kind of making sense of it, taking it in, but also sort of assessing that this is what this would be like on the stage and mm-hmm. this is what it would be like for me to direct this? I mean, that this is the right vehicle for my thesis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely takes many reads. You don't get it all on the first one. The first one through, I usually just try to read for content, get a general sense of it. But the way Lee Blessing writes specifically, he has very specific instructions, per se, before you read the play for how he wants the set to look and how the characters should be cast. And then within it, the stage directions are rather specific. And I watched an interview with him, actually, and he spoke about how important the stage directions are. He says, you know, the playwrights put them in there for a reason. They're not just in there for fun, so you should follow them. So that was actually rather helpful, because sometimes directors have a little bit of creative freedom with how they interpret the stage directions, but I tried to stay pretty true to what he wrote based on that interview, which was helpful.
Yeah, very good. So it's interesting on a lot of levels for you to be a student directing fellow students.
Yes.
How much directing have you done before this particular project?
I started directing my sophomore year, so really only 2 years. I directed in an acting and directing one acts class. I took a directing class last year where we did 2 scenes throughout the semester. And then I assistant directed Carrie last fall with Matthew Hoagland and Martin McClendon, which was a blast. And then I directed at the Kennedy Center American College Theater Festival in January of last year. So all the directing I've done has been with peers.
Hmm. I want to turn to your 3 cast members to ask them, whoever feels like saying something, what's it like to be directed by a fellow student? I mean, and in the case of 2 of you, by a classmate, versus being directed by Martin McClendon or Neil Sharnick or Herschel Kruger. Does it feel completely different, and do you have to step into this situation with any sort of a different mindset when there is this dynamic at play?
I think something that's super great about working with a student director,
this is Ellie,
is that there's such a common ground when it comes to communication styles, and it can sometimes feel like a director knows what they want from you but doesn't know how to communicate it. And sometimes it's really nice to just know your director on a personal level. Me and Emily have been friends for 4 years now, I guess. We're lucky enough for this to be our 7th show together, I think.
Wow.
Which is crazy. And I worked with her on Carrie, so I know how she works. For a time, I was a directing major as well before I shifted it. And so I really understand how she works, which is great. So it's nice to know that I know what she means when she says directions or gives critiques or feedback. It's also just been a very enjoyable experience because it's so different than anything I've done. With classes, you have your professor who teaches you in class, and then you might get to do a show with them. And so you know what their academic self is as well as what their professional sense is. But in this way, it's so interesting to see, like, it's super impressive to see how a student of yours or, like, a classmate of yours can shift to such a professional level while being so, like, communicative and, like, approachable.
Hmm. Great. It's like the best of both worlds in some ways. Yeah. I'm just curious if Lily and Jesse have anything to add to that.
I'm Jesse, and I'm just now realizing this is my third time being directed by Emily. Mm. Their very first thing for acting and directing among ads, I was actually in. I was in one of your directing scenes, and now I was, you know, very lucky to be casted in Ella Mosnary. So it's so strange to know that I've known Emily as long as a peer as I have a director, which I've loved, because I think even if I didn't know her as long as a peer, I can speak for all of us when we show so much respect to Emily. Just knowing that how hard it is to be a director, doing all the research and, you know, encouraging us to do the research and just all talking about it and making new discoveries all the time, like that relationship that we've grown, like as peers and like directors, has just kind of just added up all together, and like coming up to now and then coming up to you know, this performance week now, and it's just been something so beautiful that we've all gotten to just add together and put all our sense in to make it just this one big project that not only us, but the assistant stage manager, the stage manager, the crew, you know, the people who work on the costumes, just everyone all together just, you know, puts their all into this huge project that just all makes it know, like, where did this all, you know, start from? Mm. And then we can talk about that for hours.
Yeah, so. That's great. Do you have anything you want to add, Lily?
Yeah, just a little last bit. This is my first time being directed or working with Emily at all. Mm. But what I think that I see most starkly from other directors that I've had is Emily, I think especially because it's her senior thesis, likes to explain why she's doing something to us, which helps my process in learning something or working with somebody. So I've just found that really helpful and fun.
Very good. For those of you just joining us, we have four Carthage students in our studio for part one of today's morning show. Emily Hoffman is the director of a production that is about to open of Lee Blessing's play, Ella Mosnary. And with her, the three Carthage students who comprise the cast, Lily Anderson, Jesse Sconesi, and Ellie Nybert. And performances of Ella Mosnary are going to be coming up this Saturday, Sunday, and Monday in the Studio Theater of Carthage. Emily, let's turn to you to get a summary. I said only the barest minimum at the outset in terms of what this play is about.
So there's no real simple way to give a summary. So I'll say in the generalist of terms, it's a memory play. So it jumps around a lot. You have a main narration space where they're their set ages, and then it jumps around throughout the lifespan of each characters, spanning a large number of ages, all the way from when the middle person, Artie the mom, is 15, to when her daughter Echo is born, all the way to when Dorothea the grandmother is 75. So it goes through formative experiences in their life, wild experiments that Dorothea does as a scientist and inventor, Artie's coming of age and finding who she is in the world, Echo grappling with their complicated relationships. It's really beautiful, and it spans many years, many formative life moments.
Mm. I almost used, and I shied away ultimately from using the word dysfunctional to describe this family, but would that be accurate, at least to some extent? I mean, are there ways in which these three women, these three generations, are at least at some points dysfunctional with one another?
I would say more complicated than dysfunctional, because something I failed to mention earlier is that all three of them have this genius-level intellect. Mm. They are all brilliant. And so that, combined with some of this like generational trauma that they have and some of their life experiences, gets in their way of connecting with each other sometimes, which makes their relationships really rocky. And they're also so similar in different ways that it makes it really difficult for them sometimes to connect with each other. I would say that instead of dysfunctional.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Well, then they are not incapable of communicating with one another, or not estranged to the point where there is no connection whatsoever.
And of course.
That might be more what we think of often when we talk about truly dysfunctional families. Maybe you could say a word about this intriguing title and what the word literally means. I mean, which I happen to know, but I'll let you talk about that, and then what you see as the reason why that is this play's title, if you don't mind.
Sure. I actually was just writing a little blurb about this for our lobby display the other day. Ella Mossenary, as you'll hear in the show, it's a line. It means charitable, the giving of alms. And we have talked a lot about this, so maybe other people can weigh in as well. But there is much charity in the actions and words of the characters to each other. And sometimes it's not obvious on first glance. One of my favorite quotes from rehearsal, and we were just talking about this morning, what Lily said when we were talking about Dorothea. She said, "I'm not cruel, I'm just weird, just different." You know, the way that they express their love and communicate with each other sometimes seems unconventional and can come across as harsh or mean, but it is all with the best of intentions. So we've talked about what charity looks like for each character.
I love it. Very, very good. Let's hear from each of you about your characters very, very specifically. And maybe we should start with the oldest, with the matriarch of this family, Dorothea Westbrook, who is played by Lily Anderson. So tell us more about this character and what she experiences and undergoes through the course of the play.
Yeah, so Dorothea is Artie's mother and Dorothea's grandmother. And she is a very fun character to emulate and play because she's got this curiosity about her. She wants to know about things, and they're not always tangible. It happens more in the play. But the things that she experiments with and wants to know about are things that some people are not so believing in, like perhaps the supernatural or speaking to ghosts and whatnot. So it's very fun to talk about how can you see this as a scientific pursuit when most people don't see this as it? But to Dorothea, it absolutely is. She really wanted to go to college and wasn't able to. So that it also like grappling with that. And as Emily mentioned, this is a memory play. So it's not all from a single character's perspective. And that means that when we're all playing our characters, we're both playing our characters, but the other character's memory of our character as well. So trying to walk the fine line of what is your character actually like and what is the memory of your character, or what is the impact that you have on the other characters.
What is the age swing that you play?
I play from late 30s to 75.
Wow. I mean, it's enough of a challenge just to manage the 75 part. I mean, as someone who is as young as you are, and then on top of it, to have to sort of give that away and step into these other ages. Emily, what kind of a challenge is that for you as the director and for Lily as the actor to make that happen?
We play a lot of games and exercises. I am a firm believer in games, and I could talk about it all day long, but I won't. But we have spent a lot of time breaking down the ages by playing like more physical games and embodiment games, but we've also done the same thing for vocalism. So we've kind of broken it down instead of saying, you know, just go. We've done it part by part.
Very good. So what a challenge, what a wonderful challenge this has been, I should think, for you.
Yeah, it's been very fun.
Very good. The middle character is Artie Westbrook, played by Jesse Sconesi, who is the only junior in the room. Tell us more about your character, what she experiences, what she makes happen through the course of this play.
Yeah, so Artie is the middle woman in all the three generations. She is the daughter of Dorothea as well as the mother of Echo. And a lot of this play, at least through her perspective, how I've been perceiving Artie, is kind of what Emily mentioned, is that she is really trying to grow into herself, trying to just do everything right. And while it might seem right to her, it's not right to everyone else. And I think something that I've been finding so important in this play is perspective. is that whoever, like, if you focus on a character, you will start to understand their personal perspective, even when the other characters don't. Because they are so busy looking through their outlook and making sure everything that their outlook looks correct to them. And I think that Artie truly wants the best for her mother and for her daughter, which is why Artie makes a lot of the huge decisions that she makes. She decides when she has Echo, her husband dies a month into Echo being born. And Artie is overwhelmed, and she feels like it is, you know, best to maybe have her mother, Dorothea, look over Echo, because Dorothea may have gotten a little out of raising a daughter because Artie was running away, trying to find herself, going through a traumatic experience that she thought would just be better to be, you know, at a distance. And through that, we just see Artie trying to grow without really knowing that she's kind of hurting the people around her. And we don't really notice that until much later, until everyone's, like, perspectives kind of, like, come into view. And it's such a beautiful process of what Lily mentioned, is there is a lot of jumping around. And as much jumping around as there is, I like to think it is very followable, if that is a word. I truly think that the audience will be able to see when we are looking at certain memories from other people's perspectives, as well as what this character feels is this time and what this character is feeling during this time through such these important moments. And I just think that for this character, like specifically Artie, it is so different, as well as it is different for Dorothea, as well as it is different for Echo.
Very well put. That's great. That sounds so interesting. Last is Ellie Nybert, who is Echo Westbrook, the youngest of these three women, the youngest of the three generations. Tell us more about her.
Yeah. Echo is mostly raised by her grandmother, and Dorothea, being a very eccentric woman, raises her as such, which I think causes a lot of tension with her and her mother. Who rejects a lot of the more spiritual, eccentric ways of her mother. Echo loves spelling. Whether or not she loves it is up to interpretation, but she's very good at spelling. And she wants to be the greatest speller of all time. And so her greatness really lies in her ability to, like, understand words. And that can get in her way as well. I feel like she knows such big words for big feelings, but doesn't know how to use her own feelings. She comes up from, I play her from infant through 16 years old. So it really is a full coming of age story, understanding how to talk, how to move, and learning how those words that you say affect other people and how they can affect you as well. So I think that it is such a universal feeling that anyone can understand growing up in maybe a not conventional family setting and just understanding how she comes to be, which makes the whole thing really round out when you understand, like, you see them all start at different ages, and you see them all end, and you see how their interactions grow and affect the people around them. And I think it's really nice to have a younger end start from nothing to then have experiences.
Wow, yeah. Boy, and hats off to Lee Blessing for shaping the play in that way.
Yeah,
wow,
yeah.
That's really cool. Emily Hoffman, you were saying when I asked you before we went on the air about what this looks like, and we should again remind people that this is actually being performed in Carthage's Studio Theater. I asked you what this production visually looks like, and you were saying that Lee Blessing, the playwright, is quite specific in terms of what he desires any production of this play to look like. Tell us more.
So, first of all, performing in the Studio Theater and watching a show in there is very different than if you've ever been to the main stage, because it's so intimate. So you are right there with the characters. And then we have our set design, who is by Allison Coquenis. It's also her senior thesis project. It is very minimal. It is three platforms, as specifically requested by the playwright. The only other feature added to augment the set is a wonderful pair of wings that was made by Alyssa Sargis, and they're worn by the characters. They're functional wings. You'll have to come see the show to figure out why there's wings in it. There's also a couple book props designed by Alyssa again. As far as props and set, that's it. It's very minimal. The lighting, again, designed by Allison, is more complex because in order to help the audience shift between memory and narration space. The costumes by Emma Maynard are also more complicated because it's shifting between so many ages. Those are wonderful. And then there's some subtle sound moments by Daniel Michalik, and those are also very simple, just used to elevate atmosphere, again, to help the audience shift between time primarily.
To talk about the particular challenges, and I'm going to ask the actors in a moment, about working in the studio theater versus on the grand stage of Wartburg yes. Auditorium, what sort of challenges and opportunities does that pose for you as the director?
The blocking, you have to be so intentional. You should always be intentional with the blocking, but specifically in the studio, because it is a box, there's audience seated on three sides. So almost always you're going to be looking at someone's back. So it's a lot of staging in angles and triangles and never in straight lines. So someone can always at least see someone. And then the other main challenge that I usually think of is volume. Because of the way it's situated in the building amongst the Science Center and also in the basement, there's a lot of, there's some kind of fan or something. So there's a lot of vent noises, so you must project.
Even in this relatively intimate space. I should tell you, this is ancient history, but once upon a time, when you went to things in the studio theater, you'd also hear loud clanking in the pipes sometimes, which was so frustrating in this really, really small, intimate space. It was really hard to put that out. The last several things I've seen, there was no clanking pipes.
That's
so
good.
Something has been improved. So anyway, for our three actors, what is it? First of all, I'm curious if you have performed before in the studio theater, and otherwise, what it feels like to be in there versus on a more standard stage.
Mrs. Lilly? So I have performed in the studio theater before. I performed in there my freshman year, and I'm doing it again my senior year. So both my first and last shows at Carthage will be in the studio theater, which is very fun. I love performing in the studio theater. It's so close to the audience. I like to look at them. I don't know if they like me looking at them, but I love like direct address and like getting as close to the audience as like an audience contract allows without making anybody uncomfortable, but like letting them feel like they are part of the show. I find the studio theater such a fun space to work and play
very
in.
Good. Very good. Jesse?
I kind of going with Lily. I think you and I were talking about this, but this is my first show in the studio theater, which I am so excited about. And having it being direct address seems so perfect, and it seems almost like strange to have a show in the studio theater that's not direct address because they are so close to you. So I'm sure that is a whole challenge in of itself, as also, you know, directing and addressing the audience. It's been so cool because, like, right now we are looking at empty chairs because we're still in our rehearsal process. So something for performances is I'm very excited to make more discoveries as I connect to audiences because I'm actually allowed to, you know? So I'm very excited for that. And another thing, and Emily was, you know, touching on this, no rehearsal process when we were trying to figure something out was stressful. I'd say it was actually so much fun. And funny in a way. Emily had a bell. volume got drowned out so easily. And I was just always put a mic and just told to speak and I would be heard. But this being in the studio theater and this being a very hard space for an easy space for your voice to just completely drown out, Emily was gifted this small little metal bell, and she would ring it when she could not hear us.
Ah.
So what would happen is if you were in the middle of a monologue and Emily rung this cute little angel bell, you would have to stop, repeat the line, and keep going.
Wow.
And every time before we'd start a run, it would be some runs and not others. This is because usually volume was not always focused. Usually it would be blocking. Usually it would be discoveries. But Emily would lift up that little bell, and all of us would act like Pavlov dogs. Mm. Just be like, ooh. But it was so much fun. And I think the past rehearsals I've been noticing, it helped us get all just naturally louder. And sound is improving and will only continue to improve for opening night. So.
Fantastic idea. I love that. How about you? How about you, Ellie?
Sound for me is more of an issue. I've always had kind of a projection issue. I'm both a very quiet and a very loud person at the same time. It just depends on the situation. And this is my first show ever in the studio theater. Mm. So it's very different. Having classes in there, I've had lots of professors tell me to work on my projection, but I've never had it as a space where I work so consistently. So it's been very nice to like find success in that. We actually had a few weeks where we were in the recital hall on campus instead. And those were the best weeks for, I think, my own muscle memory, because you could hear yourself so well.
Right. It's a very resonant room. Yeah.
And in the studio theater, it kind of can feel like you're speaking into a void because you can't hear anything back.
Right.
So it was so nice to be in the rehearsal, in the recital hall, because we could hear how well our vocal work was going and how much we were projecting, and like how we were doing it very safely and healthily. And it really kind of like latched on. And I feel like since then, it's been so nice to work in the studio theater because we've been using what we learned without the feedback now, but like just trusting in our instruments and trusting in ourselves. And it has been working, which has been very, very nice.
Exciting. That's just great. So you have a few rehearsals yet to go,
yep.
And then your three performances, which of course are Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. Tell our listeners exactly the time.
Sure. The Saturday performance is the matinee, so that's at 3 p.m. The Sunday is at 7:30 p.m., and Monday is also at 7:30 p.m.
Right. In Carthage's Studio Theater, which is the lower level of the Straz building, which is where the big Wartburg Auditorium is. And we do want people to be aware that some deep personal issues are touched on through the course of the play, including things like death and dying and pregnancy and abortion and so on. And we should maybe make brief mention of someone you called the rock star of this production.
Yes, we should.
Very, very hard at work, although perhaps not seen on the stage.
Yes, we should. Lorelai Amborn is our understudy, and she has been following the tracks of all three characters. So an entire show's worth of dialogue and blocking, and she's stepped on for each character once now and has been doing a really, really great job.
Wow, very good. I'm happy and proud to hear that. Very good. All right, so three performances then of Lee Blessing's wonderful play, Ella Massoneri, this weekend at Carthage College under the direction of Emily Hoffman, a senior music theater and directing double major, the pride of Peshtigo, Wisconsin. Also in the cast, Lily Anderson, computer science major, theater minor from Rockford, Illinois. Jesse Sconesi, theater performance major, French minor from Makena, Illinois. And Ellie Nybert, senior music theater and choreography double major from Elgin, Illinois. My thanks to all four of you for being my morning show guests today. It was wonderful to talk with you, and best wishes for your performances of Ella Massoneri.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Part two of today's morning show comes from the Morning Show Archives. Any of you who love to receive or write letters, as I do, will so appreciate a marvelous new book, which is called To the Letter, A Celebration of the Lost Art of Letter Writing. And Simon Garfield, a talented and prolific writer with many books to his credit, has done a superb job of taking us through the long history, the surprisingly long history of letter writing and correspondence. and gets us thinking about it in some very, very intriguing ways. And his book is a treasure trove of examples from throughout history over the centuries of important correspondence between famous people and also plenty of correspondence between perfectly ordinary people. But it helps us understand the way in which intimate letters shared between acquaintances, friends, relatives, often bring them vividly to life the way nothing else can. The book is published by Gotham, and I'm so excited to be speaking with Simon Garfield about his book, To the Letter, A Celebration of the Lost Art of Letter Writing. Simon Garfield, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg.
You are very careful to say early in the book that this is not a book against email or anti-technology. And yet at the same time, there is, of course, that very strong thread of regret that as we turn increasingly to communication through email, text messaging, and that sort of thing, and turn away from the standard letter slipped into an envelope and mailed at the post office, that we are losing something.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I use emails as much as anyone, you know, and I text and I tweet and all that sort of stuff. And I embrace all of that because that's, you know, that's a modern way of doing things, and it's very efficient, it's cheap, and it's quick, and it works. But as you say, I think we're also, you know, facing a great sense of loss, really, because we tend not to write, you know, even emails, certainly not texts or tweets, with anything like the same sort of depth or emotion or thought that one does when one sort of just applies oneself to write a letter. And I think that's a great loss. It's a loss not only to, you know, our grandchildren, perhaps, who won't find, you know, who won't find out about as much as maybe we would find out about our grandparents through their letters, because it's going to be very hard to, you know, get through all our passwords on our computers and the cloud and all of that kind of stuff. A great loss to historians, I think, as well. So, you know, wanting to write the history of famous people now or in 50 years' time, how are they going to track their lives, if not through letters? I think that's going to be hard. But I think even beyond that, we are all losing, I think, the ability to write at a greater length, you know, because all of these things are very instant. You know, you write an email and they tend to be quite short and punchy, and then you write another one because you're replying. It's more like a sort of, you know, a phone chat in a way. You know, a lot of people think that emails are a passing phase, and it's all going to be doing instant messaging and little short messaging, and that's the way we're going to communicate. And very soon it'll all be, you know, a visual as well. It'll all be on Skype or the equivalent of something like Skype. So we're not going to leave a written record behind us. And the idea of the book is, as you say, to kind of celebrate what's gone on and the way we've written in the past and great letter writers, but also to ask the question, are we really prepared to lose, you know, all these great attributes that we get from writing a letter?
I want to ask you very specifically about a line from the chapter that opens the book called The Magic of Letters, in which you say the world once used to run upon their transmission, that is, the transmission of letters from one to another. The world once used to run upon their transmission, the lubricant of human interaction and the free fall of ideas, the silent conduit of the worthy and the incidental, the time we were coming for dinner, the account of our marvelous day, the weightiest joys and sorrows of love. It must have seemed impossible that their worth would ever be taken for granted or swept away. A world without letters would surely be a world without oxygen. I think somebody who is young enough to not engage at all in the writing of letters, I mean, they're just too young to live in the world where that was commonplace, would probably read those words and scarcely believe them. Probably can't imagine that, I mean, the world around them seems to function just fine. and doesn't need this mysterious lubricant to which you refer. Of course, I'm old enough to know exactly what you're talking about, and I'm wise enough to completely agree. So what does one say to someone who has not really ever in their young lives experienced the world as you describe it?
Well, it's very hard, really, because you can't, you know, you can't convince someone of you know, a glory of a train that used to run by anything other than kind of oil or diesel or electric. It's hard to say how glorious it must have been once to, you know, be on a coach and horses or any of those kind of things, or the early joys of kind of air travel, you know. And it's because everyone thinks, oh, actually, what, you know, every young person thinks what we have now is the best that there's ever been. And in many ways, that's kind of true, I think. As you said at the beginning, I've got nothing against these things, because they work and they are absolutely of their day. But I think with something like letter writing, you kind of have to say, okay, you almost have to put, you know, if you're talking about young people, you have to almost put things in front of them and say, okay, well, this is what my grandfather wrote, you know, during the war. And in the book, there's a wonderful sequence, which I was so fortunate to obtain from the two sons of the correspondent in the book. It's a wonderful sequence of letters during the war from a postman who was working for the Signal Corps in North Africa and Greece in 1943 and 1944. And he wrote to someone that he used to know back in London, you know, during the Blitz, and the bombs were dropping, and you get all that wonderful history, and in great detail as well. But what you also get is this wonderful developing love story between them, so they hardly knew each other. So it's that kind of thing. You sort of want to say, okay, now read this and say, this is what it used to be like, this is what we're going to lose. Now show me an equivalent in texting or emails or something like that. But the sort of scary thing, as I kind of mentioned a little bit, is that whole thing that emails are a passing phase. This is what archivists really believe now, that actually young people kind of think that, you know, the formality of an email is even too much, because you've got to sit down and write it in a certain way. You can't use text language. You have to put someone's address in the special field, and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But that's becoming too much of an effort, and all we're going to be left with are these little words, you know, little short lines in the ether, with which somehow we're going to have to patch together our history in 100 or 200 or 300 years' time. And you can say, okay, well, will that matter? But I think it does.
You take us back to ancient Rome, ancient Greece, and to correspondence as it has sort of evolved through the years. And another interesting facet of your book is, from time to time, there will be these chapters called How to Write the Perfect Letter, in which you explore some of the different ways in which one can sort of hone one's skills as a communicator in the writing of letters. And there is a wonderful chapter which is called Love in Its Later Forms, which explores this notion of the love letter. And, of course, you take us through some of history's most intriguing love letters and write at one point, "Love letters catch us at a time in our lives when our marrow is jelly, but we toughen up, our souls harden, and we reread them years later with a mixture of disbelief and cringing horror and, worst of all, level judgment." I think that's so interesting that in a sense a letter preserves a moment in our lives when we, in a sense, were someone else. And even when it is we ourselves who wrote the letter, we can sometimes read it and feel like we're reading the words of a stranger. I wonder if you could just say a word about that, if you've experienced that yourself or can think of interesting examples.
Yeah, well, I mean, exactly, you know, as you say, I mean, I wouldn't have been able to kind of write those words had I not felt that way myself when I was a teenager in love for the first time. I would write letters, and fortunately, I still got a kind of great shoebox full of letters that my first proper girlfriend wrote to me when I was 16, 17, and they're great things. They're incredibly embarrassing, of course. But they tell you who you were, you know, at that time, as you say. And they're wonderful things to have, partly also because they're handwritten and they're sort of from the heart. You know, the thing with emails is they all look the same, so you can say anything on them, but actually they will look the same as if they came from no matter who. They wouldn't have a kind of personality to them in the presentation, in the way they feel. In the book I sort of, in that chapter that you mentioned, I begin with John Keats, and he is dying, you know, in his 20s. He's in Italy. He goes to Italy because he's been told that the air there is better for this terrible disease he has in his lungs. And he writes the most beautiful letters, not only to his girlfriend Fanny Braun, but also to his friends back in London. And as you would expect from someone like John Keats, they're fantastically poetic letters. I'm lucky enough to live in London, just around the corner from where he used to live when he was in London, in Hampstead. And I went to see some of the letters there. They've obviously got them preserved behind glass cases. But they're lovely, flowery things. And you can also witness the decline in his health from the way he writes as well. It's kind of as clear as that. And then I link it to... he writes to a friend called Charles Brown. So I thought, okay, well, that's an obvious link to Charlie Brown. And then I start talking about how Charlie Brown in the Peanut strip didn't get any love letters. You know, he would have put his hand as deep, deep, deep inside in the postbox as he possibly could, you know, and there would never be anything there for him. And not all the cartoons, but half the cartoons would be about that. You know, would he get any letters from the red-haired girl that he fancied? And then I go, you know, to Charles Schulz, and when he died, these letters came out, which revealed an affair that he was having, you know, a great love affair with another woman. So, you know, it's a whole circle of life that you can link through letters, and a remarkable thing. And the thing to, you know, for instance, I have a letter. From Charles Schulz, where he obviously writes to his friend, and he has cartoons in there as well. You know, so obviously he would do cartoons of Charlie Brown or whoever, and then you look at some of the letters from the great artists. My favorite letter, which I talk about right at the end of the book, which I wanted to buy until I realized how much it was going to cost me. The fantastic letter from Edward Manet, where he writes just to a friend, but he also draws, and that's what you can't get in an email either.
That's very, very true. And you have further intriguing examples of letters of Virginia Woolf, Jack Kerouac, Emily Dickinson, an amazing five-word letter which she writes at the very end of her life, and touch on other important letters from throughout history, an account of the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. All that we know firsthand comes from someone writing a letter about that incredible moment. And that and much, much more. I think we come to the end of your book and realize that, in fact, it would be a very different world without the letters that have been written down through the centuries. The book is called To the Letter, A Celebration of the Lost Art of Letter Writing, published by Gotham Books. Simon Garfield, I thank you for writing this superb book, and I'm glad we got to talk about it today on the Morning Show.
Well, I'm glad too, Greg, and thanks ever so much for having me on.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, the author of a touching memoir called As the Rivers Merged. On Wednesday, we speak to a superb rock singer by the name of Ike Riley and two of his sons, who are the subject of a wonderful documentary that's going to be screened at Carthage College this Friday evening. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Today is going to be a sunny and pleasant day here in southeastern Wisconsin with a high of 67 degrees. Clear and cool overnight with a low of 43. Tomorrow, much like today, sunshine and a high of 69. Wednesday's high, 71. Thursday's high, 73. We could see the low 80s for a high on Friday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha Racine.